This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We're pumping out petrol no matter what cost. And now that 11 men's lives have been lost, the price is as high as rig workers can pay. Paying the price for the U.S. of A. A deep water rig called Horizon went down. No way to seal off its pipe has been found. So South Louisianans all wait for to see just what the landfall of this spill will be. People, oil, and it's oil creeping in the sea, and it's oil, and it's oil. Don't buy it at the station, you can get it now for free. Just come on down to the shoreline where the water used to be. Right.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, and in a minute we'll get to the latest scandals and horrors in the BP Gulf of Mexico blunder. But first, let's go straight to an interview with scientist John Kessler, just back from a research mission at Ground Zero, where the Deepwater Horizon drill ship sank. Around 55 million years ago, there was a deadly spike in the Earth's temperature. Scientists suspect the warming gas methane was released from the sea. It is something we need to know. Dr. John Kessler is a chemical oceanographer from Texas A&M University. He is trying to find out. When the BP spill in the Gulf started releasing large amounts of natural gas as well as the oil, Dr. Kessler assembled a team and a research vessel called the Cape Hatteras. They have just returned from the leak site in the Gulf of Mexico. Dr. Kessler, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, that leak site is dangerous with possible toxic materials in the air. Why did you want to get out there?
Well, the main reason was that this really does provide us with an analog to what these massive eruptions of methane from the seafloor might have looked like in the past. And from studying them and getting a better understanding gives us a better predictability on whether these might happen again in the future.
What is the difference between methane and natural gas?
Not a huge amount. Methane is just a more specific way of referring to natural gas. Natural gas can really refer to a variety of natural gaseous molecules such as methane, ethane, propane, butane. But methane is just one of the chemical components of that mixture. And in most environments, it's the dominant chemical component.
Okay, so how much methane do we think is coming out of this Gulf of Mexico blowout?
Well, some of the estimates that BP has published on it are that it could be in approximately the 40% by weight range. I've seen some of the estimates go as high as about 60%, but it seems like most of them are centered around 40% of the material that's coming out by weight is methane.
And how does this compare to other single release events in human history?
Well, most of the ones that we generally study, the natural releases of methane from the seafloor, are, number one, much less dramatic. They are released from the seafloor at a much slower rate. In terms of the oil-to-methane ratio, while most of the places we look naturally do have some oil that comes out of it, most of what's coming out is methane. I would say it's about 95% methane and maybe 5% oil as a ballpark estimate. But what this really does is it gives us almost an unadulterated look at the material that's coming out of the deep reservoir, whereas most of the places that we look, that oil and natural gas has to transit very, very long distances of rock and sediment before it actually is emitted to the ocean water. And so that can change the chemical makeup of it and give it more of that component towards being a higher methane content than what we're seeing here.
Well, I'd like to cover this event in three ways this methane could go. The amount that might freeze and stay at the bottom of the sea, and then the problem of oxygen depletion in the water, and then we'll get back to that question of emissions into the atmosphere. So let's start with the frozen methane called clathrates. Do we have indications that more methane will be stored indefinitely at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico due to this accident?
That certainly has the potential. What a clathrate is actually an ice-like structure. It's more or less water molecules that link together to form an ice-like structure, just like a soccer ball, really. And each of those tiny ice soccer balls are inflated by one methane molecule. These are a stable form of methane. This is a stable form of methane at very high methane concentrations, at very low temperatures like we have at the bottom of the ocean, and at very high pressures also like we have down there. But one of the things that has to be around to make them stable is a consistently high methane concentration. So as we're forming these structures, the waters, while they're very, very populated with methane now because of this spill, especially the deep waters, it's still at a relatively low amount where these structures will start to decompose naturally. The other thing about them is that they're buoyant. So as we see these very dramatic images of the oil and natural gas spewing out into the Gulf, it's spewing out into the water. So any clathrates that might form at these depths are free to float wherever they might in the water itself. And so these structures, while they will form, are going to naturally rise up through the water. The only real way that keeps them on the seafloor is when they're buried in sediments. And so unless this methane was injected deep below the sediments in a stable way, once it's liberated into the water, it's going to rise up naturally anyway and not stay in the deep.
Good enough. Well, that leads us to that question of possible dead zones that could emerge from this methane going into the ocean. And, you know, some of the wildest bloggers have predicted it will kill off all life in the sea. What is your take on what's happening there?
Well, certainly it's not going to go to that extreme. We're looking at a relatively confined area in the Gulf of Mexico. But nonetheless, this does have the potential to lead to some significant oxygen reductions in the water in these regions. In fact, some of the research that we have conducted already indicates that there are some noticeable drawdowns in oxygen. It hasn't gotten to a critical level yet where it is of any harm to the marine life, but whether that will change in the coming months, even potentially the coming years, is something that we need to investigate. The issue is this. Oil and methane being just because it's such a dominant component of what's being emitted from this spill, actually can be food for various microorganisms that live in the ocean water. And just like you and I, when we digest food, we consume oxygen. When they digest this methane and this oil, they consume oxygen as well. So the hypothesis is this. If we've loaded then the water with all of this food, will there be then a feeding frenzy that will lead to then a drawdown in oxygen as these microorganisms metabolize all of this material? And certainly we're starting to see some drawdowns in the deep waters already, but whether that will maintain, continue, and to what level it might get for it to actually be something that could be harmful to marine life is something that we just really don't know yet and will require some more study.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with Dr. John Kessler, just back from a research ship at the Deepwater Horizon disaster site in the Gulf of Mexico. John, a spokesman for BP, Mark Progler, told Associated Press, quote, "The gas that escapes what we don't flare goes up to the surface and is gone." That sounds very different from your scientific review of the problem. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, number one, I'm not familiar with it 100% what he is meaning by that quote. We were able to get within about a third of the mile of ground zero to survey both what's happening in the water as well as what's being emitted into the atmosphere. And we surveyed in a very comprehensive way all the way from that close proximity to the wellhead all the way out to about 8 miles radius from ground zero. If this gentleman is referring to what is actually being captured by their containment devices, and that gas that isn't actively flared as being emitted to the atmosphere, that might be the case. But if he's talking about gas that's not being contained by their efforts, that's going into the waters down in the deep and then transiting its way up into the atmosphere. Our measurements indicate that that component of it, the component that's not contained by the recovery efforts that goes into the water, that a very, very small fraction of it actually makes it out into the atmosphere. We found in the bottom third of the ocean water, it was incredibly populated by methane and natural gas. Most places were at the very least about 10,000 times above average, and on average, places that we saw was about 100,000 times above, more concentrated in methane and natural gas than what would normally be there. However, contrast that to the surface waters and the atmosphere in all of the places that we surveyed, and those were barely above average at all. At the very most, we saw them about 2 times above average, but never much more than background. So certainly, most of these compounds are staying dissolved in the deep waters, and a much, much smaller fraction is actually being emitted to the atmosphere.
So should we worry that this emission of methane will impact our climate?
Absolutely not. We are using this study as an analog to what a natural massive eruption of methane from the seafloor might have looked like in the past. And to use that by studying it to get a better understanding on how they might function and will give us better predictability on how these natural massive eruptions might happen in the future. Now, this man-made eruption, this man-made disaster, I should say, that's happening right now in the Gulf, while we don't know exactly how much material, how much methane is coming out of the broken wellhead, we can put conservative bounds on what that might be. And even at the high end of those bounds, this is still a relatively minor component of methane that even if 100% of it made it into the atmosphere, that there's just so many other global sources of methane to the atmosphere that this is a relatively minor source. And in terms of modern climate, shouldn't change that significantly at all.
Well, that shows how important the cumulative effects are, and there's so many other factors, as you say, the livestock industry and so on. But many of us are concerned we won't know what is happening with the ocean methanes until it's too late. I mean, there doesn't seem to be enough research on the methane coming out of the melting Arctic tundra or in those shallow Siberian seas. What sort of scientific missions should be launched to monitor ocean-sourced methane, and who should do it?
Well, there is a significant amount that is actually going on. We're doing the best that we can to understand it, working in an environment that is incredibly difficult to see the seafloor. Case in point is just this oil spill disaster itself. And while I'm giving no excuses for this disaster, certainly they're working below about 1 mile of water, and that's just an incredibly difficult environment to do anything in. But nonetheless, in terms of the research that's going on now, currently, the federal government is actually funding research to understand this massive oceanic methane system, how it gets there, what controls its stability, and understanding the releases that it might have to the ocean itself and eventually potentially even into the atmosphere. Research, national funding agencies such as the National Science Foundation, NOAA, the Department of Energy, are all devoting significant resources to understand that system, are funding both their own scientists as well as scientists throughout the academic community in the United States to go out and answer just these questions.
Well, I'm relieved to hear that it's being taken seriously. What would have to happen for significant amounts of ocean methane to be released? Is there a tipping point?
Well, that's exactly what this Gulf spill helps us to study. Most of the places that we look, and this is typically the research that's conducted in my laboratory as but one example of this, most of the places that we can study normally have a very, very slow rate of release from the seafloor. There's not really a massive explosion going on. And it's really looked at, especially in these deeper water sites, such as where the Deepwater Horizon once was, where there are very, very large stores of methane, that if there was a massive eruption, that would help to enhance the transport of this through the column of water above it and up into the atmosphere. but obviously we've never had any sort of eruption like this in human history, especially in modern human history, that we can actually look at, study, to see where that methane goes. Does it transit the water and make it into the atmosphere? Does it dissolve itself in the water and stay there so that the atmosphere never sees it? This spill itself actually gives us some insight into that problem so that we can then have a better understanding on how this oceanic methane system works. What our results have told us so far, and certainly these are tentative preliminary results, and we're doing more analyses on the data presently. We're doing more analyses on samples we brought back to the laboratory, and we'll have a better understanding of that in the coming months. But what our preliminary measurements have told us is that a very, very large component of this gas is actually staying dissolved in the deep water. If we're chopping the column of water up into about thirds, the bottom third of the column of water above the deep water horizon is really containing most of the methane that is being released. A much smaller fraction is actually transiting the water, making it up to the surface and into the atmosphere.
Well, that could be good news for now. Our guest has been Dr. John Kessler, an assistant professor and chemical oceanographer from Texas A&M University. He has just returned from measuring methane in the Gulf of Mexico at the BP leak site. Dr. Kessler, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. On the run in the 1970s. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s.
Mainstream media carefully dances with the government as they release the bad news in the Gulf of Mexico, one little bit at a time. For almost 2 months, we have heard the chorus, the only sure way to fix this oil volcano is through a relief well. All those other methods were really burning time, but no worries. The ultimate solution is coming in early to mid-August. Everything is going well, according to BP and all their talking heads. Deep down in the blogosphere, a fellow writing as Doug R. at theoildrum.com and as SHR at godlikeproductions.com wrote a detailed explanation of why the relief wells may not work at all. His arguments centered around tiny clips and insinuations that all was not as it seemed. The concrete plug at the bottom of the well, set by Halliburton more than 5 miles down, was blown out. That is what really led up the gas that blew up the deep water horizon and part of its crew. We knew that. But Doug R. suggested that the lower and middle well casing was likely blown as well. There was mainstream evidence buried in several pieces, including the Wall Street Journal, saying the Topkill adventure was called off when leaking drilling mud showed damage to the well casing, perhaps 1,000 feet below the seabed. Nobody knows the condition of the lower casing down near that actual oil deposit. But Doug R. suggested a number of forces must have damaged that casing so badly that a relief well will not work. Without a solid pipe casing, any drilling mud pumped in by a relief well will just pass out under the gulf rather than plugging up the pipe. Several knowledgeable writers at theoildrum.com, some of them oil drillers themselves, didn't like Doug R.'s theory and noted his lack of solid data or sources. But now we find a few mainstream news stations preparing us for this very scenario. The relief wells may not work. On June 28, 2010, the New York Times published an article by Henry Fountain, the title, BP Discussing a Backup Strategy to Plug Well. BP says they are just planning a backup, even if it is never needed. They would install some kind of undersea pipeline system to divert the leaking oil to an existing oil platform miles away. The New York Times finds experts who acknowledge the lower well casing could be so damaged that the relief wells may not work. An anonymous technician working on the project says the lower pipe may have been, quote, enlarged by a high-pressure flow of oil over the past 2 months, end quote. What a surprise! Exactly the theory proposed by Doug R. In my Radio EcoShock blog, I have a link to a two-hour-long podcast conference with Doug R., a.k.a. SHR, done by Godlike Productions. Or just search theoildrum.com for Doug R. and be prepared for a barrel load of controversy. Yet the bad news of no relief keeps leaking out like the oil. Here is ex-President Bill Clinton talking with Wolf Blitzer on a CNN news program associated with Fortune magazine. Clinton suggests the well may have to be blown up because the relief wells may not work. What does he know that we don't?
Unless we send the Navy down deep to blow up the well and cover the leak with piles and piles and piles of rock and debris, which may become necessary. You don't have to use a nuclear weapon, by the way. I've seen all that stuff. Just blow it up. Unless we're going to do that, we are dependent on the technical expertise of these people from BP.
Just one clarification. Are you concerned that those two relief wells that they're drilling right now, it's supposed to be ready in August, and stop this leak, might not work?
Yeah, at some point I think we'll have to ask ourselves. I just am not into this. You know, I've not been part of the decision-making process, so I'm not second-guessing anybody. I'm just telling you this is a geological monster. And I'll tell you one thing. Whoever did the siting for BP knew what the heck they were doing. It's one heck of an oil well. There's more oil down there than I ever dreamed. And it can't wait to find its way into your car because it just keeps gushing up, you know. And it's a geological nightmare. The Navy could probably stop it, but there are all kinds of consequences that would have to be considered. That is, you can't basically put in a huge amount of explosives down there. You could shut that well, but what else would you do that might upset the ecostructure of the Gulf? So I don't know the answer to that. But until that happens, until he makes that decision, to the best of my knowledge, we have no tool that belongs to the federal government to shut that well down, which means we are dependent on these people that are killing themselves day and night who work for BP or for other oil companies or engineering affiliates that are working on this.
The thing is, boys and girls, I personally rate the success of the relief wells maybe 50-50. The other possibility is this hot and heavy well will throw oil into the Gulf of Mexico for at least 6 more months, and some experts say for years. If the well blows at its current rate for years, the oil will reach Europe and even India, carried by the Great Ocean Conveyor Belt. This is a world-scale disaster. No doubt before that happens, some trigger-happy, desperate Americans will design a nuclear bomb to try and blow up the well. Clinton says a nuke isn't needed, even though the nuke experts sent down by Obama have considered it. Clinton says conventional weapons could do it. In either case, the deep-sea bed may seal up, or they may end up creating a wider channel that can never be plugged until a billion or more barrels of oil and a sky full of methane have come up out of the earth.
Look at Mother Nature all around in the 21st century.
My point for now, they are trying to tell us something. Don't count on the relief wells any more than the top hat or the top kill.
Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
I am heading out on a vacation. I'll be back in mid-August. I expect to find the deep water disaster still unfolding, still unsolved by BP or anybody else. For all we know, it may blow wide open before humans can do anything about it. The cracks and the damage may already be there. But don't listen to the wild voices claiming the whole Gulf of Mexico is going to cave in, causing a tsunami. I have been digging fairly deep into the geology of the Gulf sea floor. It is complex, to say the least. The Deepwater Horizon was drilling into a narrow ledge along a cliff where the shallower shoreline dips into the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico. I suppose it is possible that there could be an undersea landslide if the cowboys blow off some big munitions deep underground. There is also a fault line in the Gulf, but there is almost zero chance that humans could trigger a change there. But the oil and gas cavity itself is not just a gigantic hole that can cave in. The best evidence shows it to be full of chambers with supporting rocks, almost like a honeycomb. There is a larger phenomenon where shorelands in the Gulf of Mexico and some of the seabed is falling lower because so much oil and gas has been removed. This is called subsidence. Search Google for subsidence and Gulf of Mexico. You will come across the work of a lonely geologist in the U.S. Geological Survey, that is Dr. Robert Morton, operating out of the St. Petersburg Coastal and Marine Science Center in Florida. I asked Dr. Morton for an interview, but he has been out, possibly on the Gulf. Morton's longtime work has been studying the way land sinks after oil and gas has been removed. That has been well documented on the U.S. Gulf Coast in states like Louisiana and Texas. Sinking wetlands were part of the reason Hurricane Katrina was so devastating to New Orleans. The wetlands could have absorbed more of the tidal surge, but they are disappearing, in part due to the 4,400 oil and gas drilling platforms along the coast. Something has to fill all those spaces left by the former oil. Some scientists even conclude that the giant earthquake in Sumatra may have been caused by oil and gas production there. But Morton's work shows that a single well, like that drilled by the Deepwater Horizon, does not cause the collapse of the seafloor. It takes a long time with a lot of rigs. That is my reading of the science so far, though anyone should admit we are in unknown territory with a blowout this size in a well this deep. Personally, I am not expecting a collapse of the Gulf Sea floor or a tidal wave, even in the most extreme circumstances. Unless some fool tries to blow up a nuclear weapon down there, then all bets are off.
I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement. When the sun burst through the skies, there was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
My next little headline in my Radio EcoShock blog is BP fakes an island to say, we aren't drilling offshore in the Arctic. Yeah, this is some of the most disgusting news coming from Tim Dickinson, writing in Rolling Stone magazine. In the radio program, we have a brief reading with notes by Susan, host of the California social action program Raising Sand.
In an excellent piece of reporting for Rolling Stone magazine recently, Tim Dickinson writes in his article titled BP's Next Disaster that even as BP continues to spin the Gulf catastrophe, they are going ahead with plans to drill in Arctic waters and avoiding the moratorium on drilling for oil near Prudhoe Bay via an oil rig it created by building on an island. He calls it a glorified mound of gravel. It's 3 miles out in state waters. Because the island rig is connected to the mainland by a causeway, BP and Interior agree that the onshore, quote-unquote, facility is not subject to restrictions on offshore, quote-unquote, drilling. Now, this is almost, it sounds so ridiculous, it's almost like the spoof we just saw, but apparently it's true. Tim Dickinson writes, first, the company will drill 2 miles beneath its tiny island, which it has christened Liberty. Then, in an ingenious twist, it will drill sideways for another 6 to 8 miles until it reaches an offshore reservoir estimated to hold 105 million barrels of oil. This would be the longest extended reach well ever attempted, and the effort has required BP to push drilling technology beyond its proven limits. As the most powerful land-based, quote-unquote, oil rig ever built, Liberty requires special pipe to withstand the 105,000 pounds of torque, the equivalent of 50 Mack truck engines needed to turn the drill. Says a top BP official, this is about as sexy as it gets, he told reporters in 2008. BP, Dickinson calls a repeat felon, is subject to record fines for its willful safety violations, and it's calling this project one of the biggest challenges to date, an engineering task made even more dangerous by plans to operate year-round in what the company itself admits is, quote, some of the harshest weather on Earth. Now, again, this is a Rolling Stone magazine that Tim Dickerson writes called BP's Next Disaster. He continues, the Obama administration has been warned by its own scientists that drilling in the Arctic poses a grave risk to the environment. Last September, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration urged the president to halt future leases in the Arctic, warning that the federal regulators operating on Bush-era guidelines had, quote, greatly understated the risks of drilling. Both industry and government, the scientists added, displayed a, quote, lack of preparedness for Arctic spill responses, unquote, and had failed to fully evaluate the potential impacts of worst-case scenarios. And what, you may wonder, is the Obama administration's response? Well, BP's project has the blessing of Minerals Management Service. You may recall this is the government agency that oversees offshore drilling. According to Dickinson, last year, 1 month after it gave BP the go-ahead to drill in the Gulf, the Minerals Management Service, or MMS, bestowed a leadership award on the company in recognition of Liberty's visionary approach to drilling. While regulators must still approve the final paperwork for the project, MMS tells Rolling Stone that it considers Liberty safe. It says that BP has the capacity to respond to a world case discharge of 20,000 barrels a day, and adds that, quote, the island has been designed to contain service liquids within the footprint of the island, unquote. Moreover, Shell has received all the environmental permits it needs to drill 5 exploratory wells in the Arctic. According to the environmental assessment that Interior conducted last December on Shell's drilling plan, quote, a very large spill from a well control incident is not a reasonably foreseen event, and therefore this environmental impact does not analyze the impacts of such a worst-case scenario, unquote. Now, Shell is the 8th largest corporation in the world with a disturbing environmental record. Last year alone, its operations in Nigeria spilled at least 100,000 barrels of crude. And again, I'm going to remind you that one barrel is equal to 55 gallons. So what is the response plan that Shell has put together in case of a disaster? Well, it says that it is only prepared to respond to a spill of 5,500 barrels a day, a fraction of the 60,000 barrels currently estimated to be pouring into the Gulf, and that's a low estimate. Shell claims that because it would be drilling in shallow waters of roughly 150 feet, its operations in the Arctic would be safer than BP's well in the Gulf, which ruptured 5,000 feet below the surface. But the government's own data shows that most blowouts occur in shallow water, and the 10-week-long gusher that followed the blowout of the rig last fall in shallow waters off the coast of Australia is proof that catastrophe can strike at any depth. The Arctic, it turns out, is not the only place that the Obama administration is poised to give oil companies a new lease on life. In another indication that the president's 6-month moratorium on deep water drilling may be nothing but a stalling tactic, MMS has continued to accept bids on drilling tracts in the Gulf. Indeed, since President Obama announced his halt to deep water drilling on May 27th, MMS has approved bids on at least 96 tracts in deep water. 2 of the bids are from BP, and 1 in the same undersea canyon where the company's gusher continues to foul the Gulf. The White House contends that MMS is simply finalizing paperwork from bids submitted prior to the disaster. But environmentalists are aghast. Quote, these new leases are based on the same fundamentally flawed and patently illegal environmental analyses used to greenlight Deepwater Horizon, says Mike Senatore of Defenders of Wildlife, which filed lawsuits against MMS in June to block the expansion of drilling. Quote, this agency is at the epicenter of the worst environmental disaster in history, and yet it's still going about business as usual. So I have a link to this full article. It's again a Rolling Stone magazine article by Tim Dickinson called BP's Next Disaster. And that is our show for the week. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, visit our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to other shows.
The U.S. government issued a moratorium on offshore drilling in the Arctic off Prudhoe, Alaska. To get around that, BP created a man-made island out of gravel. Then they claimed they were not drilling offshore, but on land. BP is using this ruse to set up another possible catastrophe, this time in the remote Arctic. They intend to drill about 6 miles sideways under the sea to reach a large gas and oil deposit deep down, but they say they're doing it from land. What could possibly go wrong with a world-class company like BP? Why does the administration allow fakery to skirt around a protective moratorium? Will BP paint their fake island green? Just this week, British scientists released a report outlining how very dangerous drilling in Arctic waters would be. Basically, there is no way to recover from a blowout like the Deepwater Horizon mess. Some oil goes out under the dark ice. Due to the cold water, there are fewer organisms to break it down. Some of it may remain in the Arctic environment for decades or longer. And no relief rig could get to the scene, possibly for 9 months, and then they wouldn't have time to drill the relief well before the pack ice returns. Drilling from the ice is not possible. It is a guaranteed disaster with no way to fix it, no way to clean it up in the Arctic, just like the Deepwater Horizon on steroids. But this land drilling from a fake BP island is still going ahead, even as the company and the country founders in a volcano of errors and oil. But let's not get caught up in the single biggest environmental disaster in history, that BP spill. It is already bigger than Chernobyl, and the destruction of the Amazon was not a single event. Bhopal killed more people in the initial explosion, I grant you. Yet all the time we see news anchors broadcasting from the Gulf, you know they are missing the biggest disaster ever facing this planet. I am saying climate change has arrived and in force. I regret I have not had time this season to cover the many extreme precipitation events in just the past few months. From America to China and beyond, humans have been flooded out. The reports are always the same. New records, some 500-year-old records, some more than a foot or a third of a meter of rain falling in 24 hours. Guangdong's Hulai County in China got 2 feet in 24 hours. Wherever these extreme rains hit, the roads, the fields, the towns flood out. No current drainage systems can handle it. People die. This is a herald, the other side of global warming, global wetting. Even a slightly warmer world takes up much more precipitation, and something in our atmosphere, possibly the great cloud of dust and pollution we humans create, is causing this excess rainfall to come down all of a sudden in different locations all over the world. Many of us are going to be washed out repeatedly. And the weathercasters always describe it as a freak isolated incident rather than tying into the pattern of global wetting. I give you in my blog a quick report on the subject from Joe Rahm at the blog climateprogress.org as he quotes Dr. Kevin Trenberth, head of the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Trenberth says, there is a systematic influence on all these weather events nowadays because of the fact that there is this extra water vapor lurking around in the atmosphere than there used to be, say, 30 years ago. It's about a 4% extra amount. It invigorates the storms, it provides plenty of moisture for these storms, and it's unfortunate that the public is not associating these with the fact that this is one manifestation of climate change, and the prospects are that these kinds of things will only get bigger and worse in the future. And that's a quote from Dr. Kevin Trenberth. You can find more about that from climateprogress.org. The other big story, which I tried to cover a couple of weeks ago in my program titled Heat Stroke, is surely the heat. You know, before I do interviews that you hear on Radio EcoShock, I always ask my guests to describe the weather in a few words so I can set their sound levels. Otherwise, people start right in on the interview before I've got the equipment set up properly. Lately, the answer from Washington, D.C. to Texas is always the same, an exclamation mark about how unbelievably hot it is. Over at Wonderblog, Jeff Masters explains, quote, extreme heat wave in Africa and Asia continues to set all-time heat records. That was June 26, 2010. Quote, a withering heat wave of unprecedented intensity and aerial coverage continues to smash all-time high temperatures, Asia and Africa. As I reported earlier this week, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Chad, Niger, Pakistan, and Myanmar have all set new records for their hottest temperatures of all time over the past 6 weeks. The remarkable heat continued over Africa and Asia late this week. The Asian portion of Russia recorded its highest temperature in history yesterday when the mercury hit 42.3 degrees centigrade or 108.1 degrees Fahrenheit at Belogorsk near the Amur River border with China. The previous record was 41.7 degrees. Also on Thursday, Sudan recorded its hottest temperature in its history when the mercury rose to 49.6 degrees centigrade or 121.3 degrees Fahrenheit at Dongola. The previous record was 49.5, set in 1987. We've now had seven countries in Africa and Asia, plus the Asian portion of Russia, that have beaten their all-time hottest temperature records during the past 2 months. This includes Asia's hottest temperature of all time, the astonishing 53.5 degrees centigrade or 128.3 degrees Fahrenheit mark set on May 26, 2010 in Pakistan. All of these records are unofficial and will need to be certified by the World Meteorological Organization. And that is the end of a quote by Jeff Masters at wonderground.com, spelled W-U-N-D-E-R, and you can find that link in my blog. Where is Senator Inhofe, the oil man, now? The man who built the snowman outside Congress to laugh at Al Gore. And now we see Al Gore is being smeared with sex just like his former boss Bill Clinton. Obviously, if Al Gore had sex urges, as a hotel masseuse alleges from several years ago, now trumpeted by the front page of the National Enquirer, well then everything Al Gore ever said about climate change is a lie. Sex outside marriage means science isn't true, you know. Read that in blogs all over the net, those crazy anti-science people. Al Gore may have to make an exit as an ambassador of climate change now that the dirty media are bringing out his laundry. Forget having a personal life if you challenge the fossil fuel industry. According to the blog The Hill, quote, Al Gore is trying to translate new federal data on global temperatures into political momentum for climate change legislation. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported last week that worldwide temperatures for May and for the January-May period were the warmest on record. Quote, every month we delay work, the planet continues to warm. The Senate needs to take action on the climate bill immediately, Gore wrote on his website Thursday afternoon, and that's an end quote from the blog called The Hill. And Al Gore is right. Climate change is a bigger disaster than the BP blowout in the Gulf. Heat and wetting is planet-changing, my friends, for eons. The Arctic ice is melting so fast this year it is set to beat the 2007 record minimum. That's totally scary. The dark ocean will grab more heat. Nearby Greenland cannot help but be affected. Scientists have just announced that the Arctic was much warmer than they thought, 19 degrees hotter than today, perhaps 4 million years ago. And they worry we're headed right back there. Good luck living on that planet. But hey, failing energy supplies will probably hit your lifestyle first. And for all the finance reading I've been doing, I don't doubt that a second depression is also on its way. It could happen soon, or could slowly unfold over the next 2 or 3 years, but the system is way past bankrupt. Read James Howard Kunstler's blog for June 28, 2010, titled Say What? To find out more. That's at Kunstler.com. Meanwhile, here is a quick clip from a woman named Stoneley speaking to a transition conference in England. The talk at the Seal Hayne Agricultural College in Devon, UK, was titled Making Sense of the Financial Crisis in the Era of Peak Oil.
So my writing partner and I moved on to found our own site so that we could discuss whatever issues we felt to be relevant, particularly finance, because finance has the shortest timescale, shorter than energy crisis. In other words, it ends up being a defining event for the kind of time frame that you have to play with. So it's something exceptionally important. So we're going to look today at global expansion and contraction, the dynamics thereof, and what are the key drivers over time. We're going to concentrate on energy and finance, and there's water and climate change and pollution and population and any number of other things that we could also discuss. However, we don't have all day. So I'm going to focus on the things that are the shortest time frame and that are extremely significant factors going forward. Some of this particular audience will be more familiar with than other audiences I've spoken to, so I may skim over certain things and expand a little more on others. But in terms of finance, we're looking at deflation and depression. And in energy, as I'm sure you're aware, we're looking at an energy-poor future. It really is going to amount to a century of challenges. And this is the URL for the Automatic Earth, in case anyone may not have seen it before. So energy is the master resource, as again, I'm sure you know, and that we live on an energy inheritance, whereas other societies have lived primarily on energy income. And we're burning about 400 years' worth of the Earth's primary production every single year, which is clearly not something we can continue to do infinitely into the future. Production from our inheritance is peaking. In other words, when you have a large inheritance of something like oil, it's not simply how much there is in the ground that matters. I mean, we still have quite possibly half the oil there ever was in the ground. However, it's how much can you produce from that at any one time. And there are limits, especially because we have cherry-picked our energy inheritance and we've produced the easiest, cheapest energy first. What we have left is the much more expensive and difficult energy to produce. And as we move into using much more expensive, difficult-to-produce reserves, the amount that we can produce every year is going to decline. So we are going to have less energy available to society, even although we are not running out of oil in the sense that there not being oil under the ground. So essentially, if you look at the spike that represents oil production, the hydrocarbon age is a very fleeting era in human history. There were no hydrocarbons up until recently. We'll have them for a couple of hundred years, and then they will be gone again. Not that there won't be any hydrocarbons, but we won't be able to produce them as an energy source because it will take so much energy to recover them that we would not be gaining any energy for society to use in the process. So this really is a sort of once-in-a-planet's-lifetime bonanza that we have experienced. And we are going to be moving forward into living on an energy income as other societies have done before. So I wanted to start to look at the interaction of energy and finance. Energy subsidies drive economic activity because energy is the capacity to do work. That's not particularly surprising. However, when you have very large energy subsidies, you can fuel financial bubbles, which is exactly what we've experienced in recent years. The fossil fuel era has led to the largest bubble in human history by some considerable margin. However, once you have created a bubble, you do not require a trigger for it to burst. Bubbles are inherently self-limiting. You don't have to then run out of energy in order to have a serious problem because a bubble is inherently self-limiting. It will collapse under its own weight all by itself, whether you still have energy around or not. So what we have done is created a structure whereby finance will be the primary driver to the downside. In the next few years, over the short term, finance will be the driver. It's not that we will not have enough energy. In fact, we will appear to have plenty of energy, as we'll see in a little while. For a short period of time, energy will not be a limiting factor, but finance will. The reason for that is that finance is based on pyramid dynamics, along with an enormous number of other things. All bubbles are grounded in pyramid dynamics or Ponzi dynamics. Structures that are Ponzi schemes always depend on the buy-in of new entrants. And there's an enormous range of activities that come within that general category. There are pure pyramid frauds where the founders will set something up. The only money that ever comes into the system is the buy-in of new entrants. It lasts about four iterations, then the entire thing collapses. The founders run off with all the money because it was a pure fraud, and it's over. However, there are a number of Ponzi schemes that have other sources of income besides the buying of new entrants. That same fundamental dependency means they will end the same way, but they will last an awful lot longer if there are other sources of income. In some cases, there's no intent to defraud. Any kind of multi-level marketing system where you buy into someone else's team and then you're supposed to attract other people to your team and whatever they sell, you get a percentage of it, and the more people further down the line, the more the people at the center are bringing in every month. That's absolutely a pyramid scheme, things like Amway, Avon. However, there's no intent to defraud. These are legitimate businesses, and the founders, I think, just did not understand the logic of their own business model taken to its logical conclusion. There are other things where there are other additional sources of income. One of the things I studied as an academic was pyramid schemes in Eastern Europe on the collapse of communism, particularly in Albania. There were some extremely egregious examples of bubbles there. They had much less wholesome additional sources of income. We're not talking legitimate businesses here, at least vanishingly small amount of it was from legitimate business. There was oil sanctions busting and gun running and drug smuggling and human trafficking and car theft from all over Europe. And what these things all did was to bring in a lot of new sources of income. These pyramid schemes ran for years, and running that long, they were able to suck in 80% of the population by the time they burst. And so 80% of the population in Albania lost everything in a very short space of time. stock market bubbles are pyramid schemes, housing bubbles are pyramid schemes. There are an enormous number of activities that have that same need to continue to expand or they will collapse. And in every pyramid scheme, only the early entrants really ever make any money. People who come along late are the nominated empty bag holders, the people who will be holding whatever it is at the point where it is no longer worth anything. And unfortunately, the public ends up buying into these things usually very late. What they're basically doing is saying, give me that empty bag. That they don't realize that's what they're doing. But at that point, the insiders are only too happy to say, oh, here you go, by all means, and run off with the money. And the house of cards always comes down in the end when you have something based on pyramid dynamics.
And that was part of a two-hour talk, almost, plus the Q&A by Stoneleigh. Stoneleigh was a biologist and environmental consultant. As she said, she's a lawyer and a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, writing papers on lax nuclear standards in Eastern Europe and electricity policy. She is now living in Canada and at one point ran a biogas producers association. Stoneleigh was also an editor at the Oil Drum Canada, a peak oil and energy analysis site. She moved on with a man named Ilargi to found one of the top eight most visited financial blogs called The Automatic Earth. Radio EcoShock has an interview with Ilargi in our show broadcast April 17th, 2009.
I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen ones.
Well, I'm going on vacation, and my vacation is also part of our family plan B, should the economy totter and fall. We have found a nice cheap piece of land in a village along a mountain-fed river with good growing conditions. Slowly, we've been adding to the existing mobile home with the eventual intention to make it self-sufficient. The best we could expect in a crash is a peasant existence without the riches of the current false economy. But we have done it before, bootstrapping up from nothing without electricity to 90% self-sufficiency, I would say. If this extend and pretend stuff we're seeing in the economy no longer works, I may keep broadcasting from a small place in the mountains if the net still works at all. Personally, I agree with Stoneleigh that the economic disaster will come even before peak oil or climate change. Perhaps this is why many of our most downloaded programs are about the economy. I encourage you to load up your iPod, computer, or MP3 player with the eight most downloaded Radio EcoShock programs for your summer listening. Get tuned in before the great correction comes. Say, you know, we hit more than 25,000 programs downloaded in this past month of June alone. Join all those folks by going to our main page at ecoshock.org. Sign up for our podcasts, which resume September 1st, and find our summer program schedule to grab the most popular pieces as selected by you, the listeners. I want to tell you about another Good Green listening experience. Last week I had a visit in our Vancouver studio with Jordan Popenck, a driving force behind the Canadian show The Green Majority. That is billed as the country's only dedicated environmental news hour. The Green Majority is produced at CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, Canada, by volunteers from the University of Toronto. The program has proved really popular, being rebroadcast by another 13 stations in Canada from coast to coast. Normally, it's hard to find reporting of environmental affairs in Canada other than isolated pieces, almost always written from a growth and business perspective. The CIUT students dig deeper, read between the lines, and take events from the Arctic warming to inner-city recycling as serious and worthy of your time. No celebrity bump or political propaganda, just a real news show. Jordan Popenck is heading off pursuing his postgraduate work in psychology, but he's spending the summer cycling across Canada to raise awareness of the need for a steady state economy instead of endless consumption and planet deadly growth. He is backing CASE, the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, which is easy to find at steadystate.org. I was going to interview Jordan, but ran out of time as I prepared our summer programming while packing for an extended vacation in the mountains. My apologies to Jordan for an opportunity missed to talk about the pleasures and problems of trying to produce Real Green Radio. Find the Green Majority program, complete with free MP3 downloads, at besustainable.com/greenmajority. besustainable.com/greenmajority. Of course, you can just sign up for their podcast at the usual places, from iTunes to podfeed.net. If you are tired of the BS analysis or blackouts of the environment at your local newspaper or corporate TV station, tune in to the Green Majority for an hour of Canadian and international news.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth May. I'm leader of the Green Party of Canada, and you're listening to the Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Hello again, environmentally conscious listeners. It's time again for your weekly dose of Canadian news, features, and punditry from a uniquely green perspective. Or as a podcast over the internet, you are listening to The Green Majority. The address is greenmajority.ca, and you can go there any time of the day or night to access our program and news archive going back over the last 4 years.
Heaven knows we can never have enough environmental coverage. There are a bunch of listeners I would like to thank for their tips and help this year. Too many to read them all out now, but Carl, thank you for maintaining the Green 960 page and helping me out with technical stuff. I appreciate the virtual renderings by Chask in Colorado and Pop Defect Radio from Skidmark Bob for all the great and weird clips you provide for us independent producers. And Dana Pearson was a real find for green songs, like his newest version of Corporate Catastrophe, now available on our music page. Just look for the audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org and scroll down a bit, you'll see music. And singer Steve Forbert has updated his monumental oil song, adding the BP gusher in May of 2010. The sad list now takes 13 minutes for him to sing with the chorus. That is on our music page, or better yet, go to steveforbert.bandcamp.com. Thank you, Guy in Australia, green journalist Stephen Leahy in Toronto, and just dozens and dozens of tipsters and friends I've made over the net as Radio EcoShock keeps rolling out week after week. And that's just what will happen again, possibly in late August, certainly in September, as I crank out another 45 nonstop shows. Don't worry, there will be plenty to talk about, maybe even to cry about, as 2010 continues to unwind. I've been teasing you throughout the show with versions of Neil Young's song After the Gold Rush. You may have heard it covered by the trio Emmylou Harris, Linda Ronstadt, and Dolly Parton, or one by the Alice Band, and the funky take by a group called The Endless. We'll go out with a classy new version by Canadian K.D. Lang. Don't forget to try out our summer programs and downloads. I'm Alex Smith, signing out. Thank you so much for listening. See you in September.
Dreamed I saw a silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen ones. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new
Maybe, just maybe, we can do better. Here are the Dixie Chicks.